This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jill Havenstein went to Afghanistan in 2004 for a worthy project, but without the resources to accomplish the goals. The project was to create jobs that would provide an alternative to growing poppy. The Afghan government had promised to eradicate the opium poppy fields in the Helmand province. The U.S. Agency for International Development had hired a contractor to create jobs that would provide economic alternatives to poppy. Havenstein was hired by the contractor as deputy leader of the project, running the operational side. To meet payroll, he had to find ways of moving $1 million in cash each month to the Afghan frontier, a place without banks. Before he had a safe, he carried thousands of dollars in his pockets. His job ranged from planning work sites to buying shovels. Jill Havenstein, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe the goal of your project in Afghanistan during the period that you're writing about?
The goal of our project was really to provide a temporary cushion for the rural economy in Helmand Province. USAID knew that they didn't have alternatives in place to offer the farmers, alternative crops, alternative sources of credit, alternative ways of farmers to make a long-term living. And so for that first year, before they had a chance to introduce those long-term alternatives, they ordered a couple of USAID contractors to go into the provinces with the most poppy cultivation and to just create short-term cash jobs, sort of a New Deal-style project where you got tens of thousands of Afghan farmers, gave them picks and shovels, and sent them out to fix up the canals, to fix up the roads, to do, in a sense, deferred maintenance on these things that hadn't been that had just gone into extreme disrepair during the war years in Afghanistan.
Now, a question you raise in your book is, why would a farmer give up the perfect crop? Why is poppy the perfect crop in Afghanistan?
Well, in Afghanistan, because of the long war years, a lot of the orchards growing fruits and nuts that farmers made their living off of before the war were destroyed or mined. The roads were wrecked. Electricity was wrecked over most of the country. And so you really need a crop that doesn't require refrigeration, that can be transported over bad roads without bruising or falling to bits, and then can be sold on international markets. And opium fits that bill perfectly. Also, because of the way the whole rural economy is structured, a lot of the poor farmers there can't get access to land unless they grow poppy. The landlords will order them to grow poppy on this sharecropped land. And they don't have access to credit. They can't get loans to tide them over from when they plant to when they harvest. And the poppy traffickers will pay them at the time of planting for a certain amount of opium at harvest. So in all those ways, poppy is better suited than any other crop right now for farmers to make a living.
So how many jobs did you have to create, and how much money did you have to pay in this attempt to lure people away from growing poppy?
Well, our aim was to pay more or less 50,000 people over the course of 1 year. We were basically going to pour about $10 million in salaries into the province. Now, if there'd been a thoroughgoing poppy eradication program in the province, that wouldn't have actually made up more than $10 million, well more than $10 million is involved in Helmand Province in the poppy industry. But we thought that if there was some attempt at poppy eradication, we would try to fill the gap with cash so that the bottom didn't just drop out of the rural economy along with the poppy.
One of the biggest problems you had, perhaps the biggest problem that you had, was security. What are some of the options that you had for providing security for your men and for protecting them, for protecting the payroll?
Well, a lot of aid agencies in Afghanistan choose to go largely unprotected in their work on the idea that if you have men with guns, you're more likely to make a target of yourself. And initially, we tried to keep a pretty low security profile. When we sent payroll teams out to pay our workers, then we would send police along with them, local police. But for the most part, we tried to get by without armed guards for most of the time. And this was at a time when Helmand Province was a relative oasis of calm in the south. So it wasn't crazy to think that we could do that. A lot of other groups down there did. But we quickly found that because our payments were getting us into political feuds, we'd go to a district and unbeknownst to us, would be paying perhaps more people from one clan than another. And that would put our guys in danger. And we eventually got a carjacking in which a couple of our engineers were briefly abducted from one of our work sites. And after that, it became clear that we would need to take stronger measures to protect our staff.
So what are your options in terms of hiring security?
Well, at that point, you have the option of hiring a private security company. I mean, we've probably all heard of Blackwater and Dyncorp and some of these other companies that have a big presence in Iraq and Afghanistan. But those come very expensive, and USAID, especially in Afghanistan at that time, was reluctant to authorize the millions of dollars that it could take to pay one of those companies to protect a project. There was one company, a security company, that did come at USAID rates, but that was essentially because they just took these unreconstructed Afghan militias and hired them. So these groups weren't very disciplined, they weren't reliable, and they had their own feuds that they were carrying on. So really, some of the projects I worked on worked with this group, and I just felt that really for our project, they'd cause more trouble than they solved. And that unfortunately left us with the only option being to work with the local Afghan police to request from the governor of the province a unit of Afghan police to act as security escorts for our project and to do our best to train them and discipline them, equip them for the job.
How effective was that?
It was an extraordinarily difficult job. We found very quickly that the Afghan police had all the same bad qualities as the militia groups that we'd seen working with the private security companies. Because in essence, after 2002, the U.S. and NATO focused a lot of attention on reforming the Afghan army and have actually seen some fairly good results from that. But police reform fell through the cracks. And as a result, the police, even today in Afghanistan, are for the most part still militia groups, often with a history of banditry. And it takes a vast amount of work to discipline them and give them any sort of professional structure.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joel Havenstein, and his new book is called Opium Season, A Year on the Afghan Frontier. And it's about the year that he spent working for a private contractor in Afghanistan, contracted by USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development. And the job was to create projects that created jobs for people in Afghanistan as an alternative to growing poppy. Okay, so we were talking about how big a problem security was for you and your team. How many people did you lose?
In May 2005... our project was attacked, we were told, by Taliban. And initially, five of our colleagues were killed out in a monitoring visit to the field. And then the following day, the funeral convoy of one of those casualties was attacked, and another six lost their lives, so 11 in total.
How did you get the news?
I was at that point packing to leave. I'd just got engaged and was on my way out from the project. And I got the news of the first attack when I was back at the guest house tying up some loose ends. And the following day, after I'd been to the funeral of one of my friends who'd been killed, a car screeched up, and we heard the news about the funeral convoy, and I didn't believe it. I thought it was just a rumor that had been spread in the wake of the first attack. But then we got back to the office, and I got a call from a journalist who was with the bodies and who said that the only identifying mark on the six dead men was my business card, which is in the pocket of my friend who was killed. And that was the point at which I knew that that the project was going to collapse.
And was that the end of the project?
It wasn't the final end of the project, but we stopped all of our activities, pulled out the expatriate workers, first to the PRT military base and then to Kabul. And eventually, at this point, USAID was working on getting the long-term project going, the long-term alternatives. And they decided that they would just roll what was left of our project and its staff into the long-term project rather than keep it going as planned until the end of its one-year span.
What kind of turning point was this in your career and in your life? And I ask this knowing that you felt a sense of personal responsibility for the security of the men who were killed.
It was, obviously it was a shattering moment. I felt that I and my colleagues, you know, while we had had no good options to choose from with security, obviously the option that we ended up choosing, working with the police, hadn't been enough to protect our men from being killed. And yet I had by that point formed very close bonds with so many of the Afghans that I worked with. And they continued to believe in the possibility of reconstructing the country. They continued to ask for me to come back and help them. I guess this was a turning point in that USAID and the State Department began talking more about acceptable casualties in the reconstruction of Afghanistan, and I resisted that and continue to resist that. I don't think that that's an approach that we can take with these Afghan staff, but I still am committed to the reconstruction of Afghanistan and to trying to make it happen in a way that doesn't risk the lives of the people that we work with.
My guest is Joel Havenstein, and he's the author of the new book, Opium Season, A Year on the Afghan Frontier, and it's about the year that he spent heading up a project with a private contractor that was funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. And this was a project whose goal was to create jobs for people in Afghanistan to convince them to give up growing poppy or working in the poppy economy. He's no longer working on that project, but he is back in Afghanistan working on a similar project in a different region in the north of Afghanistan. Now, Joel, you spent part of your childhood in Nepal. Your father is a missionary, and when you were growing up, you know, he was in Nepal and other countries too?
At that point, we were just working in Nepal. Since our family left Nepal, he's worked in a lot of countries across Asia.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, he goes to Afghanistan a couple of times a year, and you did some traveling with him while you were there. You write in your book there was a profound difference between what had brought my father to Afghanistan and what brought me here. What are some of the differences you see between the work that he's done abroad and your work?
Well, I think when you you look at this mission ethic that I grew up with, it's people who had a really serious long-term commitment, a vocation to help people in a particular country. And as a result, they'd go there and they would learn the language. They'd live there for, you know, a decade or two. They'd be working on, as doctors in the hospitals. My father was an engineer building hydroelectric projects and hospitals. And by contrast, it's pretty common in the professional development industry, the contractors for USAID, for people to take one-year stints or even shorter ones. They don't learn the language unless it's a sort of regionally useful one like Spanish. And there's not a commitment to the areas in the same way that I saw growing up in that community that I lived in. And as a result, you get these turnover problems where people are always leaving and taking their knowledge with them, taking their achievements with them and their relationships. And I certainly felt bad about being part of that.
That you were one of those people who come and go and doesn't make the long-term commitment.
Well, exactly. I mean, I've been in and out of Afghanistan since 2003. And so far, the longest stint I've worked there was the 6 months in Helmand.
But you do to keep going back.
There's been something about Afghanistan, the beauty of the country, the friendships that I've made there, that does pull me back. And I am open to and looking for possibilities to stay there for a longer-term project that I think is really making a strong positive difference.
You know, I would think that part of the attraction of doing aid work or any kind of service work in a developing country is the sense that, like, your work will be valued and appreciated. You are giving of yourself to help others. But in a situation like yours, you're in Afghanistan, and particularly in the period you describe in the book, you know, some people really appreciate the work you're doing, but a lot of people would prefer to kill you because you're American and because you are against the poppy economy, which a lot of people benefit from, and because the Taliban benefit from the poppy. So what's it like for you, knowing that you're trying to do this, you know, service work, but at the same time, there are a lot of people who'd like to kill you for it?
In a way, it's encouraging. I mean, certainly it's frightening. But it's not that the people that we're trying to help as such are hating us and trying to kill us. The people who are trying to take over the country and bring it back to a Taliban government, or the people who want to keep the war economy of smuggling drugs, guns, and crime going, they are opposed to us and they are potentially trying to kill us. But in terms of the reward, I feel like the fact that the people we're trying to help are by and large, you know, show gratitude, and the people who are trying to derail the progress in the country are trying to kill us. You know, those are both, in a way, they show we're on the right track. It's when we have complaints from the people who we're trying to help that it gets discouraging. It's when projects, you know, you try to organize a project that has good effect, and for one reason or another, it is ineffective when people complain. You know, that's the day when you go home and feel like, gosh, what am I doing here? I should just go back and be a temp in New York.
Does that happen much?
It happens. It has happened in, I think, pretty much every aid agency and development project that I've seen. It's just not an easy thing to do. There are a lot of political forces pulling in different directions, both U.S. political forces and Afghan. There's a lot of ways for well-intentioned projects to slip up. But, you know, you do also see projects that work and have a positive effect, and those, you know, that's what keeps you getting up in the morning.
When do you go back to Afghanistan?
I'll be heading back on Friday.
Well, Joel Havenstein, thank you very much for talking with us. Good luck and be safe.
Thanks, Terry.
Joel Havenstein is the author of the new memoir, Opium Season, A Year on the Afghan Frontier. He's still working in Afghanistan on a different USAID project. He returns there Friday.